Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D Monocle 24's weekly dedicated design show. I'm Henry Rees Sheridan. On today's show, we pay a visit to two exhibitions looking at the social and political impact of architecture. First up,
the whole generation of architects, artists, designers set out to rethink what a new society could be, what a new city could be, and how to design the new human, the new life.
A trip to London's Design Museum to explore Soviet architecture and design in the decades immediately after the revolution. Next,
the notion of building a landmark like this with the idea of bringing people from all over the world to this new nation, this is a great commission.
To New York for an exhibition looking at how liberated African nations used modernism to assert their own identity. Plus, James Taylor Foster joins us in the studio for a roundup of the latest architecture news. All that coming up right here on Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. We start in London, where recently I paid a visit to the city's Design Museum, which is currently running a new exhibition called Imagine Moscow. Here's a report. This year is a centenary of the Russian Revolution, and London's major cultural institutions are marking the event with a spate of exhibitions. The Royal Academy of Arts just wrapped up a survey of Russian art made in the aftermath of the revolution, while the British Library has artefacts on show, including Lenin's handwritten application for a reader pass. The Design Museum is no exception. It's currently running an exhibition called Imagine Moscow: Architecture, Propaganda, Revolution. It looks at the work of a generation of Soviet architects and designers working in the 1920s and early 1930s. The catch is that none of the projects were ever built. Instead, they're represented by large-scale architectural drawings, artwork, propaganda, and publications from the period. The exhibition's curator, Esther Steierhofer, met me at the museum to give me a guided tour.
Right after the revolution, Moscow was rendered the new capital of the Soviet Union. So a whole generation of architects, artists, designers set out to rethink what a new society could be, what a new city could be, and how to design the new human, the new life for Soviet citizens. So it was kind of a really important time. And the exhibition is trying to look at this very vivid period of the 1920s and the early 1930s before Stalin really finally consolidated his power, when, you know, suddenly or slowly, gradually, the avant-garde movements were replaced by a new socialist realist style, which became the only and official style of the Soviet Union. But before that, there was a quite diverse landscape of designers and artists working. So I think in some ways also the aspirations of this exhibition show this diversity of the landscape and the differences. So it's not, we are not only talking about constructivism, but many of the artists were inspired by suprematism and many other thoughts, expressionism and so on and so forth. So they worked alongside and they were in dialogue. So it's a kind of a very turbulent time with many different ideas and languages that were around.
The first exhibit you encounter looks at a structure called Cloud Iron, a bold architectural proposal from Russian avant-garde artist and designer L. Lissitzky.
Cloud Iron is a groundbreaking proposal, architecture proposal by L. Lissitzky. L. Lissitzky was an artist, designer, architect who worked very closely with Malevich in Vitebsk. His proposal for the Cloud Iron, so-called Cloud Iron, was presented for the first time in 1925, and basically it is a network of horizontal skyscrapers that were organized around the center of Moscow, around the Ring Boulevard, in the main intersections.
And what was trying to be achieved through this design?
Well, first of all, it's actually a quite pragmatic way of looking at the new capital and the problems, the new urban problems of the capital. So it was trying to tackle the problems of overcrowding, the insufficiency of infrastructure and public transport. So the Cloud Iron was this horizontal skyscraper that would link the nodes of transportation with office spaces above the city, that were extended above the city. But beyond this very pragmatic proposal, it was also a much more poetic and abstract way of looking at how to reform and how to rethink the city and how to colonize the skyline and introduce a complete new language from skyline.
When you think of Soviet architecture, massive, striking structures come to mind. But the reach of collectivist ideology stretched beyond such monoliths and into the homes of ordinary families. The communal house designs of architect Nikolai Ladovsky show the extent to which the Soviets wanted to use architecture and design to influence the behaviour and ideals of ordinary citizens.
Moscow was rendered the new capital of the Soviet Union. But, you know, one of the first problems that the Bolsheviks encountered when looking at the capital was the housing stock. There was insufficient housing stock. So the first instant solution was, of course, appropriation of existing housing. But then, you know, the next question was how to house the masses and how to come up actually with completely new housing typologies. What you see here is a proposal by Ladovsky. It's one of the earliest projects, actually, in the exhibition. It's from 1919-1920. It was presenting the first idea for a so-called house commune, which would show a new way of communal living. It's a symbolical project. This, again, remain on paper. So what you see here, the house has this spiral spatial diagram, which is embracing a central courtyard, and the individual living units are linked together around this spiral ramp, which, of course, as in Tatlin's proposal for the Third International, it was a very symbolical and significant spatial symbol for progress in time and in society. So Ladovsky worked closely together with Mapu, who was a younger architect, and they developed certain versions, which you can see all around here on the walls of the exhibition. By the late 1920s, communal ways of living and communal housing became a much more important and much more pragmatic question for a set of new architects. So among them, what you can see here is a timetable proposed by Nikolai Kuzmin, who's one of the most progressive thinkers in relation to the communal house, which is proposing a scientific organization of life.
6 o'clock wake up, takes 5 minutes, early rise. 6:50s walk to coal mine, perhaps a slightly outdated idea now. At 17 minutes past three, you're meant to spend 8 minutes washing your hands, which seems like an awfully long time.
I mean, if you think about being a coal miner, it suddenly all makes sense, right? So this was developed specifically for the idea of coal miner. But it's quite interesting and quite entertaining to think about it, how precisely it was calculated, the time that you need to spend in every single activity. But even not only about, you know, this activity is washing hand and having your dinner, but also walking from one place to another. So that was becoming part of the design to facilitate, you know, these routes and activities.
Depictions of Vladimir Lenin are everywhere in the exhibition, from iconic posters to the 100-foot statue of him that was meant to top the never-built Palace of the Soviets. Esther explained why.
Lenin died in January 1924, and he was actually buried three times on Red Square. So the first time, Shusev, who was an architect in Moscow at the time, he built a wooden temporary mausoleum. But, you know, masses were coming from all over the Soviet Union. It's a massive territory encompassing 11 different time zones. The masses were coming to see the body and say goodbye and pay their respects. So it was very soon recognized that Lenin's personal cult can become
a form of propaganda.
Yes. Yeah, so it was a very tightly controlled way of how Lenin could be depicted. It was Merkurov, the sculptor who took Lenin's tat mask, which you can see a small newsreel and video of him in his studio. We have a 7th section in the exhibition that is reconstructing the mausoleum. In some ways, it is different from all other case studies in the exhibition because the mausoleum eventually was built. In fact, it still exists. It stands in the center of Moscow. The body is still on open display to the masses. But it is the geographical and ideological center of all what was happening at the time.
You told me before we started recording that there are a few kind of officially approved Lenin poses which can be used, right? You can't just kind of show him doing anything.
Yeah, so one of them that you can see also on the top of the Palace of the Soviet is the so-called orator, where Lenin is holding up his right arm and pointing up in a diagonal, as if pointing upwards and onwards. So in some ways, you know, we decided to reconstruct in a scale model Lenin's index finger, because that is such an important part of his iconography. But also finger in Russian actually rhymes with the word palace, which is quite interesting. And other, there is a very beautiful Mayakovsky poem which is talking about how the fingers, the individual fingers, come together in a fist as the individuals coming together in a collective and become stronger. So there is a lot of symbolism involved in there. And of course, this diagonal movement is echoing many of the other, you know, in early typography, the sign of the exclamation mark, or the architectural diagram of the spiral, are all the symbols that are echoing this vision of progress at a time.
Imagine Moscow is a fascinating insight into a particular time and place in history. But as Esther explains, the exhibition also helps us better understand the origins of ideas that have influenced some of today's biggest architects.
In some ways, if you think about it, 1917 and the October Revolution is still one of the most important political moments. And the relationship between architecture and its political project was so explicit. It's a very heroic moment for architects to really think and rethink the task of architecture. So in that sense, I don't think that in the last 100 years there is any moment comparable to this. So it's still one of the most relevant moments to go back to. But beyond that, of course, if you look around, what is really striking for me is the freshness of the language of this architecture. And it has to do with many different things. First of all, you know, in the 1970s and 80s, a whole generation of neo-avant-garde architects were rediscovering the historical avant-garde. So if you think about Zaha Hadid, Rem Koolhaas, Peter Eisenman, even Norman Foster, and so on and so forth, they were all looking at these archetypes and drawing inspiration from them. So in many ways, you know, our contemporary landscape is populated by images that are very heavily influenced by these archetypes or ghosts of architecture, plans that were never built, and yet actually their power in some ways comes from the fact that they remain in imagination.
Esther Steierhofer there, curator at London's Design Museum, showing me around the exhibition Imagine Moscow: Architecture, Propaganda, Revolution. It runs until June the 4th. Now, we may think of Europe or North America when it comes to ambitious and avant-garde modernist edifices. But that would be missing a trick. In the late 1950s and stretching into the 1960s, over 30 African countries became independent. And when they did, they wanted buildings that reflected a positive, modern and free new identity. An exhibition currently showing at New York's Center for Architecture, called Architecture of Independence, traces this movement through images and artifacts. Monocle's New York Bureau Chief Ed Stocker went along to find out more and spoke with the center's lead design educator, Tim Hayduck.
So we're looking at the Arch of Independence, which is in Accra, Ghana, and it's been described as being sort of the gateway to the African continent. And it's this really wonderful monumental arch which supports a couple of levels, one of which is for the president of Ghana. But what's wonderful too is we're in this large space, and this is one of the photographers that worked on the show. It really gives you a sense of being there. The figures are not quite human scale, but the photograph encompasses the entire wall. And what's wonderful, too, is the photographers for the show did not exclude people in them. This is something that architectural photographers have done for years. They just want us to look at the architecture. But here we really get a chance to see in almost every photograph the people, how they use the buildings, how they experience the city, whether they're selling things, whether they're relaxing. And there's so much life in almost every photograph that you see.
I know what you mean. It almost blends into the realm of travel photography. I mean, these are very much images that are lived. Looking at this arch, we can see a couple on a moped. There's another guy walking to the right of the picture, and there's even a bit of rubbish on the ground. They're not too cleansed, I guess. They look real. They show architecture perhaps how it should be, being enjoyed and used and lived around.
Absolutely. And several of the large murals that we have in different locations in the Center for Architecture depict different street scenes.
And they become a really wonderful introduction to some of the landmarks that are featured in the show. Iwan Bond spent a lot of time walking around the cities before he specifically photographed the landmarks. And those large photographs really give us a sense of what life is like in these cities.
For example, actually, just behind where you're talking, we're looking at this incredible kind of modernist roof with these columns jutting up. And, you know, it's been used as a covered market, just showing how, I guess, some of these designs may have had different concepts behind them when they originally built and they've kind of been repurposed as time has gone on.
I agree. And I think what's really important about a show like this and the research that went behind it is that many of these spaces are threatened. So we are witnessing photographs of places that may not be here in the next few years. The new leaders of these recently liberated countries were really looking for architecture that was going to point in a direction of newness, modernization, many of the things that the colonial powers promised but did not deliver on. And so these countries made new alliances with other countries outside. Unfortunately, these countries didn't have schools of architecture. So they did begin to partner with places like the Nordic countries. In the minds of some of the African leaders, that was a great match because the Nordic countries had little to no involvement in colonialism.
I'm just going through a doorway now, and we have these wooden frames in front of us with pictures in all of them, and they have a little explainer next to them. They're kind of subdivisions of this book, I think. Maybe you can just tell us, Tim, how this exhibition was conceived and how based on the book is it?
Like the book, the exhibition covers the five countries, Ghana, Senegal, the Ivory Coast, Kenya, and Zambia. And each particular country is then represented by a handful of landmarks. And there is also probably a 25 to 30 foot long vitrine with some really wonderful artifacts, including some original sketches, some video of some important political things that have taken place at some of these landmarks as well. But each frame that you mention, you know, they're beautifully arranged. Each one is sort of a story about the building that is framed. So there's a bit of text and also a map to locate the particular landmark, but then there are these really beautiful photographs that show some of the context of the buildings and then zooming into some of the details.
Tim, what I like about this main hall is the fact that there's a display case right in the middle that's made from wood. But I like the way the legs that are shaped like the letter A have kind of echoed the modernist feel of the entire exhibition.
Absolutely. Mid-century modernism was a really fun time where architects were beginning to use a lot of new forms. We can kind of talk about how architects were form givers at that time, certainly playing with patterns, especially for screens when it came to warm climates. There was a need to shade the interior from the hot sun, but also to allow cool breezes and natural ventilation. So yeah, the forms of these legs are really great. And I think you mentioned that there are also these great decals that are on the window, the front window.
Love that.
Yeah, they're really fun, and they represent silhouettes of some of the major landmarks from around the region. And I don't know, like, I don't have any tattoos, but I kind of feel like, you know, maybe one or two of these could be a really cool inspiration for something like that.
Maybe you should get one, Tim.
I think I might need to get one after all these years.
Final question. Do you have a favorite building as you've wandered these rooms looking at all the different edifices? Is there something that you go back to have a look and marvel at?
Absolutely. It's the Kenyatta International Conference Center in Nairobi, Kenya. And it was designed by a Nordic architect who worked very, very closely with the president of Kenya at the time. And this was kind of a dream commission. It was an office tower, which was initially built for the political party of the country, but it also included a large conference center. And the notion of building a landmark like this, with the idea of bringing people from all over the world to this new nation, this is a great commission. And not only that, it's a beautiful building. There is a sort of a meeting chamber that is of the scale of the United Nations, yet it has a roof that was inspired by a closed lotus flower, and on the top of the tower, that portion of the building was terminated by an open lotus flower. There's a beautiful chevron-shaped pattern of wood paneling that helps filter the natural light that comes through. The oculus of this chamber is actually made out of these fins of concrete. It's really a stunning, stunning space. And then there are, you know, sort of a Pyrenean-like series of spaces that lead you up into the conference center. It's really a remarkable building.
Tim Haydock there, lead design educator at New York's Center for Architecture, speaking to Monocle's New York Bureau Chief Ed Stocker. Architecture of Independence runs until May the 27th. Still to come on the show, Arc Daily editor James Taylor Foster joins me in the studio to discuss a voyeurism controversy at London's Tate Modern, Apple's new HQ, and contextualizing the internet. Stay tuned.
Pack your bags and join us on a global tour through exciting and inspiring cities. From Madrid to Miami, Tokyo to Toronto, we've created travel guides that will help you get the best out of a city, no matter how short your stay. We'll whirl you around some of our favorite architectural spots, top cultural haunts, and then point you in the direction of a well-earned drink from a little-known cocktail bar. We've also scouted the prettiest running routes, the most design-savvy shops, and the best hotels to comfortably rest your head. View our full range of travel guides at monocle.com or visit any good bookstore and plan your next escape today. Cities are fun. Let's explore.
Now, we recently welcomed James Taylor Foster, European Editor-at-Large at architecture website Arc Daily, to Midori House, Monocle's HQ here in London. He joined me in the studio to talk about the latest developments in design and architecture, beginning with a controversy at London's Tate Modern Art Gallery.
I'm sure most people, most residents of London or people who have visited recently have gone to the Tate Modern, and the Tate Modern have just opened this enormous sort of fortress-looking building at the edge of the site, which is new galleries, and of course it has a wonderful viewing platform at the top of it. It was designed by the Swiss practice Herzog de Meuron. The issue that's arisen is that this new building, this kind of big public building, we should say, is directly opposite a large complex of luxury apartments designed by Roger Sterk Harbour and Partners. And the issue is that from the top of this viewing platform, people are looking into people's houses and apparently taking pictures, using binoculars, and people aren't happy about it.
And what's being alleged specifically?
A breach of human rights.
A breach of human rights.
I think it's a very interesting discussion about how buildings are orchestrated in a city. I mean, I don't know why these buildings are so close together. I don't know how people didn't foresee this, to be perfectly honest with you.
It is absurd how close together they are.
It is absurd. You can see right totally, into. Totally. And of course, the argument from the Tate is install some curtains or some blinds, which, to be perfectly honest with you, would be a sensible idea, because what you're looking into are not necessarily bedrooms. You're looking into kind of enclosed terraces. So it's technically partially outdoor space anyway. But, you know, these people are upset that their privacy is apparently being compromised. You can see their point to a certain degree, but at the same time, is it worth raising such a fuss about? I'm not so sure.
And arguably, this building shouldn't have been the way it is in the first place, right?
Well, I think the buildings were essentially designed irrespective of one another. And I think that's the root of the problem here, is that, yes, a viewing platform is a wonderful idea, but it seems bizarre to me that this wasn't foreseen.
Moving on to a completely different part of the world, California, where the Apple campus is having the final touches put on it.
Yeah, so this project's been going on for a very long time. But this month, Apple employees will start to move into the new Apple campus in Cupertino, and as 12,000 employees will move in there. The whole point of this campus, this kind of enormous donut, kind of UFO thing, in the middle of, we should say, one of the most volatile geographical structures in the world, of San Andreas fault line, is not too far away. So it's a big investment. In spite of that, 12,000 people will be moving in. The whole of Apple's entire divisions will be consolidated into one space. And I was actually with the architect, Lord Norman Foster, the other day, and he kind of refused to talk about it because it's super, super secretive. The entire project, as is the case with any of Apple's products, there is no indication of what it's like inside. We understand that some people will be given a view in, but it's basically like Willy Wonka's chocolate factory. There'll be one view in, and then no one will ever see it again unless you work for Apple.
Now, although we can't see inside it, there are videos online of drone flights over the site, so we've been able to track its development that way. Now, has your analysis of it as a piece of architecture changed over the course of its construction, and if so, how?
I think the best way to describe how this project began was as an enormous version of an Apple product, right? So the attention to detail was absolutely incredible. And of course, as pictures have emerged, and Apple have released some images, but as we've seen these drone films, which I'm sure Apple are not pleased about, suddenly we see this, what must be one of the most expensive buildings ever constructed in modern times, materialize to this level of detail. So we know, for example, that a special form of glass manufacturing has had to be created in order to create these kind of swooping, possibly the biggest panes of curved glass a building has ever seen. And of course, we know that Steve Jobs didn't want any reflections in this glass, which is an incredible ask for an architect, because you're going to have reflections. There's ideas that, you know, the lighting, the ventilation will not be reflected in the glass. These are complex architectural problems which has taken a very long time to resolve. So I think we're all very excited to see whether it's worked.
And Foster and Partners, arguably this is going to be somewhat of a crowning achievement in the career of Norman Foster himself. The right man for the job?
Yeah, I think he was the right man for the job. I think what we have to remember, and he told me that this anecdote recently, is he remembers having the very initial conversations with Steve Jobs over pizza in their kitchen, you know? And he said that the first diagrams they drew are true to what has been built now. Of course, we have to remember that the chief, I'm not sure of his exact title, chief product vice president, you know, these American titles, Johnny Ive, who designs all of Apple's products, is British. I know that they are close friends. So I think this has been a major long-term project, both on Apple's side and Foster and Partners' side, and I think absolutely a crowning achievement for both companies.
And finally, we're going to move online. We're going to talk about something called Arena. I want you to tell me basically what it is.
So Arena, ARE.NA, and that's also the web address, is essentially a platform for collaborative and independent research. And what it essentially does is create this new lens for surfing the internet, for capturing things from the internet, web addresses, images, text, and then contextualizing that content.
And it's useful to designers because they're people who, and architects as well, who do need to encounter a large amount of information over the course of their day. They necessarily encounter a large amount of information. But critically, too, it's an intrinsically collaborative practice.
It's an intrinsically collaborative practice. And I, you know, even though we're talking about architects and designers here, it's beneficial to everybody. Because, you know, the thing about the internet, as it evolves, is it actually becomes more dangerous in some ways in terms of the amount of data we're faced with. And a lot of people assume that everybody has an inbuilt filter to navigate through this. But of course, you know, it's very difficult to conjure one of those when, you know, we're used to things being almost washed over us. This offers you a way to go fishing in the ocean, right? And then collate those fish and keep them for another day. So it basically gives a more meaningful experience.
Arc Daily editor James Taylor Foster there. That's it for this week's show. My thanks to our editor, Alex Funnell. If you have any comments or queries, then feel free to email me at hrs@monocle.com. You've been listening to Section D. I'm Henry Rees-Sheridan, and until next time, it's goodbye from me.